acknowledging your own discomfort with it and that you're going to try to work through that. And then that's the important process, not necessarily exactly what you say, but that you're willing to say, hey, this is, sex is a thing that people do and we talk about it.
Yeah.
Even though it's hard to talk about, we talk about it.
I'm Erin Walsh. This is Connected and Courageous, the art and science of showing up for kids in the digital age, a podcast from Spark and Stitch Institute. If there is one topic that we adults tend to both avoid talking about and simultaneously be in desperate need of information and support around, it is internet porn. It's not just that porn is hard to talk about. It's also that porn brings us on this collision course with all kinds of topics that are tricky for so many of us to talk about, and not the least of which is acknowledging that young people are sexual beings. This, in and of itself, is no small task. That's why it is so helpful that we have people like Dr. Megan Maz to hold our hands as we walk through this. And we do need to walk through this because, as Dr. Maz reminds us, in our media-saturated world, we no longer have the luxury of silence. Talking about sex and porn inevitably brings up our own experiences, our own values, our own stories and beliefs inherited from culture and families of origin. It brings up a lot. That's why I think you should keep listening. And I think you'll appreciate this conversation with Dr. Maz. Because as we work to raise sexually healthy and competent teens, she invites us to consider why teens need us to step into our role as sex socializers. Spoiler alert, you don't need to actually memorize an entire sex ed book to have these conversations with our kids. Why today's free online porn is different, fundamentally, from pornographic material from our childhood and what that means for young people today. And yes, this is what we all need. Ways to get conversations started, questions we can ask, and yes, even specific talking points if those work for you. Dr. Megan Maz is well positioned to walk us through these big topics. She is an assistant professor in human development and family studies at Michigan State University. She received her PhD from the Pennsylvania State University as a pre-doctoral fellow funded by the National Institutes of Health. Her award-winning research, recognized by the American Psychological Association, focuses on adolescent sexual development. Specifically, she investigates how experiences of social media, sexting, and online pornography play a bidirectional role in the development of attitudes and behaviors related to sexuality and gender. As a former health educator turned academic, she has trained thousands of teachers, social workers, and school counselors on pornography use among teens for over 13 years. Her goal is to prevent sexual violence and promote sexual health among adolescents and emerging adults. In addition to publishing in academic journals, she also publishes her work in mass media outlets such as HuffPost, CNN, and Salon. And Dr. Megan Maz is here with us today. Well, Megan, I'm so grateful that you're here, and I'm so grateful for your work in the world, because when we think about the kind of work you're doing and the kind of conversations you're having around, let's just be honest, when it comes to parenting and educating tough topics sometimes, like porn and sex and sexual identity and sexual health, these are topics that you not only have incredible command of in the research, but you're able to translate them into more easy to understand and accessible information and advice, which I rely on and so admire, which is part of why I'm thrilled that you're with us. And I'm always curious, you know, what drew you to this work in particular, given that they are hard for some of us to talk about just in our homes, and you are on stages, you are in classrooms, you are in schools having these conversations all the time. So what drew you to this work?
Well, thank you so much for just acknowledging the work and some of the difficulty that comes with it and the importance of it. It is not easy to do all the time. It has gotten easier over the years, but it's still, there's still tough topics to study. And I wish I had just an amazing story to answer the question of why I do this work, because I get that question a lot. And what I can say is that my why has changed a lot over time, mm-hmm. particularly having my own kids now. It's a very different why. But when I first started, I think I was drawn to these subjects kind of in part, in some ways, due to my personality. Even as a little kid, and you know, in other topics now, like money and death and other things that people find uncomfortable to discuss, I tend to love those discussions. And I've always been drawn to the elephant in the room and discussing things that people seem to be uncomfortable discussing. So I think that helps a little bit. I also had a unique experience growing up where I had a mom who was very willing to talk about sex and bodies and was very positive about all the things. Mm-hmm. But I would often not take her seriously because I would look around at the culture or what my friends were saying or what the boys at school were saying, and it just did not align. Yeah. And then furthermore, you know, would look to media experiences and examples and then think, oh, no, we're supposed to be like this and this and this, you know. And so I think I had just a lot of cultural internalized shame, yeah. That kind of everybody does because around sex and sexuality, even despite a fairly positive mom. And so over time, I've realized it's not just that we have parents who talk about these things, but we have parents who address the culture and the media, and that we have supportive school environments and educational programs that address cultural issues and stigma and media. It's not just about the talk.
Yeah.
That there are so many layers in our sort of ecological social systems that need to be addressed in order to prevent some of the most horrible things like sexual violence.
Yeah. There's so much in what you just said that is so moving. It feels so important. I am a parent of a middle schooler, and I will never forget when we were doing one of the sex ed classes that he was engaged in. It was just a circle of caregivers before they did their series of classes. And one of the questions the facilitators asked was like, what are the stories that you've learned about sex? And every single parent was like, to be shamed, to feel bad, to feel silence or to feel confused. And I was so struck by that experience of having all these adults in the room sort of unearth some of the shame, and doing some of that work becomes so important as we think about how we're engaging with yes. our kids. And I, you know, that idea that we're not just going to solve this and create a culture of healthy sexual communication and healthy sexual development just in private one-off conversations, but really around culture. I love in your TEDx talk, I think you talked about like we live in this media saturated time and we no longer have, I don't want to directly quote you, but something like the luxury of silence. Yeah. Certainly as I think about my kids now in their completely media immersive life, that those cultural messages are coming through stronger, more often, and take up a lot more of their time.
And they're so much more engaging and entertaining than yes. a lot of the messages that they might receive in educational settings or even directly from us. So there's a yeah. lot of unlearning to be done.
Yeah, the sort of default sex educator. Can you speak to that a little bit? I mean, I do think so often in parenting or teaching, we do look back to our own families of origin and our own sort of cultural moment, which has changed so dramatically. And some of the things that I hear from parents as I'm talking with them about this topic are things like, my kid's kind of too young to talk about that, or they probably haven't seen it yet, or is it really that bad or that concerning, some of the content. Can you speak to some of those maybe myths or why do you think it's so important to talk to kids kind of early and often? And what do we need to know about today's cultural context that maybe will help motivate us to be brave and have those conversations?
Yeah, I mean, so kids have been talking to each other about sex, you know, elementary school kids since, you know, when our grandparents were kids. So there's always been a need to start some conversations early. Having continual conversations is so important because it just socializes that this is something that we talk about and it's okay to talk about it. But what's unique right now is how easily accessible internet pornography is. So, you know, I joke about in talks that I give, you know, the kinds of things that I had access to as a teen through trying to sneak a peek at like HBO After Dark at a slumber party.
Took effort.
Yeah, it took effort. Yeah. And like, I could have never seen the types of things that kids are seeing now.
Yeah.
So the accessibility has changed, not only just to porn or like watching people have sex, but watching fairly violent and aggressive sex acts. And so we know now that over half of kids have seen internet porn by the time they go to high school. So at the end of middle school.
Yeah.
And then over half of them have seen violent sex in porn. So and then by the time people are 15, 16, the majority have seen porn multiple times.
Yeah.
So those stats are coming down. It didn't used to be that frequent. Boys' frequency of use, daily frequency of use is going up. That's becoming more common to see it daily than it was 10 years ago. For girls, it's more common that they're seeing it, but the frequency of use is not necessarily changing. Okay. And then we don't know a whole lot about more gender diverse kids or non-binary kids. So in terms of prevalence rates, but I would say to parents, it's happening, or your kids are seeing porn in middle school, if not earlier. And what they have access to now is it's a lot. And I'd be happy to talk about specific acts. I've done that in other podcast episodes, but I know it's also can be a lot. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that that is such a helpful reminder, because connecting the dots with your expertise in adolescent development in general and in the context of porn, you know, I think sometimes parents, when I talk to them, they're like, I don't want to introduce the idea of porn. Like, I don't want to introduce the idea of sex because maybe if I start talking about sex in the internet, then it will like spark an interest that wasn't there. Right. And it's a sort of reminder that kids are talking about sex. Kids are, especially by, you know, adolescents, they're thinking about sex. That is normative. That is that is healthy. We're not introducing that idea. And I think your reminder that it's already happening. So do we want to talk about it or not? And your reminder and your cautiousness around even sharing verbally what kids will see is kind of a wake-up call in many ways, right? That we have to sort of ask permission, like, can I even describe what I'm seeing in like mainstream free pornography right now? Because even the description can be a lot for audiences, and yet that's what our kids have sort of at their fingertips.
Yeah. And it's even been described in some cases as a traumatic experience for some particularly younger kids, because what they're seeing is aggressive, or it's, you know, an older person who's with, you know, hopefully someone who's 18, but they look like they're 14.
Yeah.
So mimicking, you know, sexual abuse scenarios, you know, or seeing aggressive, just aggressive sex acts. And so, you know, what might have been funny or kind of like alarming in terms of like the porn that we might have had access to as teens, or that, you know, Gen X parents even millennial parents would have access to as teens, you know, that's not.
It's a different ballgame.
they're just seeing. They're seeing stuff that was not even possible for us to see.
Yeah.
But the other thing I really want to relieve parents of is that we don't make anything interesting for our kids.
Yeah.
You know?
We're not the
influencers. I wish I could. Yeah.
We are not their main cultural influencer.
No. So
we're influential in other ways, but not those ways.
Yeah. No, like if we bring up something that they don't already know about, they're not going to be like, wow, that sounds amazing. I'm going to go do that. For the most part, when we bring up something, it immediately signals to them how boring it is or dumb it is or what have you. And so, yeah, I would just comfort parents in knowing, trust me, like we wish we could make things sound appealing to our kids, right?
I really appreciate that reminder. And it's such good expectation setting too, right? To not set expectations that they're going to turn to us and be like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful, enlightening. Please tell me more and drop your wisdom.
Yeah.
That is very typical and developmentally right on time for them to roll their eyes and groan and tell us that we don't know anything. And part of the art of parenting a teenager is to sort of forge ahead anyway, not with lectures, but with planting those sort of seeds over time and knowing that it's very appropriate for them to.
Totally.
One of the many things you are so brilliant at is just walking us towards those conversations really thoughtfully. Given the context of the porn industry today and the ubiquity of the images and how easy it is to access, I know this is a huge question that we could take hours answering, but do we have a sense of what some of the impacts are? Like, what are we most concerned about if we don't have those conversations?
Yeah. So unfortunately, we do not have studies that are showing positive associations with porn viewing in particular among teens and their outcomes or just, you know, correlated behaviors. So what we do know for at least in terms of, you know, to date for people who are under the age of 18, there's a little bit more nuanced findings for college students, which makes sense because college students are adults and they have some context and they have some experience under their belt. But adolescents who are usually sexually inexperienced don't have a whole lot to really put what they're watching into context or to think critically about it, they tend to be more vulnerable to assuming that what they're seeing is something that they can expect in real life or something that they can ask somebody else to do. And when you're seeing different types of behaviors that are overrepresented in porn, so for example, anal sex is shown a lot in porn, more so than it is, you know, documented in terms of just human activity. There's nothing wrong, you know, with it. But but expecting that somebody is just going to engage in it without any discussion,
right?
That can be a traumatic experience. It could even be sexual assault.
Yeah.
We're also seeing other behaviors that are like slapping, even what they call choking during sex or strangulation during sex is becoming more common. And we're seeing the stats of that being more common among young women. So Dr. Debbie Herbenick at Indiana University, she really leads this work. And she's found that 1 in 3 women were choked at their last sexual experience. So that's not even just lifetime.
Yeah.
That is the last sexual experience. And of them, 50% of them were first choked between the ages of 12 and 17. And so I think what's at stake here is perhaps not just even unrealistic expectations in terms of what should feel good or what bodies should feel like, but perhaps either agreeing to some of these more aggressive behaviors when you don't want to, or kind of pressuring another person to engage in these more aggressive behaviors when they don't want to and thinking that that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was so thoughtfully shared. And, you know, one of the things we've said for a long time at Spark and Stitch is whoever tells the stories defines the culture. That's not new. That's been true of humans forever and ever.
Yeah.
And when we think about sort of sexual scripts and sexual storytelling, if we sort of outsource all of that to an industry whose core purpose is not like, how can we grow and raise sexually healthy and happy kids.
Right.
That is not the business model. I gotta say, my stomach is like,
I know. I
mean, in a way, that's okay. I mean, I think sitting with those feelings and as parents taking those deep breaths, right? That we, when we hear these kinds of things, making sure that we don't just immediately turn around, rush into our kid's bedroom and be like, but that we like sort of sit and regulate our own nervous systems and be like, okay, so then, you know, what, given what is sort of at stake, given what's accessible, and given the goal, which is to raise healthy, you know, sexually healthy kids who don't have shame and fear around their bodies, who understand boundaries and understand intimacy and pleasure. Like, those are huge goals. And I love your idea. Let's see if I'm going to say it right, that, right, you invite parents to be sex socializers, or we are sex socializers, not just sex educators. It's not just delivering facts mm-hmm. or delivering words, but really yeah. socializing sort of their identities and their, you know, how they approach this. Let's start walking towards those conversations.
Yeah. So I think it's important to note that you can just first start off by, you know, either apologizing for not having these conversations sooner if you haven't. Mm-hmm. If you've already had some conversations, to say, you know, I know it's uncomfortable, or I'm thinking back at when we did talk about, you know, where babies came from, or we talked about X, Y, or Z. And I just want to revisit this and let you know that I don't want you to feel like I do about this. I'm uncomfortable with this for a variety of reasons. But all of us are really hoping that your generation feels differently and can communicate about these types of things with each other and think about their own sexual selves in a more positive way. You don't have to necessarily say all that, but you could start off by just saying, I want to talk more. I'm sorry we haven't talked more. Acknowledging that, you know, your own discomfort with it, and that you're going to try to work through that. And that's the important process, not necessarily exactly what you say.
Yeah.
But that you're willing to say, hey, this is, sex is a thing that people do. And we talk about it.
Yeah.
Even though it's hard to talk about, we talk about it.
Yeah. But I love that, in that reminder of, with all of these sort of tougher to talk about topics, that we don't have to have it totally together. And it's okay to just say, I might be a little fumbly, I might be a little awkward, but this really matters. And you really matter to me. I feel like you deserve this information. I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that reminder. And then I know for topics like this, what's been really helpful for me is to have some of those talking points sort of ready to go, knowing that I might be feeling a little fumbly. And I say that with a little bit of caution, because I think sometimes when we start talking about like parenting scripts, people can get really nervous about memorizing like specific words, or knowing that everybody has different identities and different family histories and cultural contexts, that we're not all going to have the same words, and that's okay. But I do think having a few messages from like, what does the research say, is helpful for teenagers to know.
In terms of what is evidence-based, we really don't know at this point. Yeah. There is a program called The Truth About Pornography by Emily Rothman and her team, Dr. Emily Rothman, and that has shown to change youth belief in, you know, pornography being realistic, or being an occupation that's relatively risk-free, you know, those types of things. But in terms of what messages about porn, you know, change adolescent decision-making when it comes to sex and relationships, we don't have data like that yet that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
From what I hear and gather from our health educators in that role, is that there is a need for teens to understand that it's unrealistic, but they get that message a lot. Mm-hmm. The message that they're not really receiving is that you have no idea if what you're watching on these tube sites is consensual, is consensually shot, is consensually uploaded. So for example, MindGeek, they own the top five tube porn sites.
Yeah.
And they verify the age of the uploader, but they don't verify the age of every single person in a video.
Got it.
And I think a lot of people are under the impression that everybody's been age verified that they see. And that's not the case. That's really hard to do. That would require lots of money. Many people working to make that happen. So I think really focusing on that you don't want to be contributing to somebody's trauma. You don't want to be sharing that. You don't want to be using that for pleasure. Those are important pieces to think deeply about. Because there's this human piece there that is getting lost. And that doesn't necessarily get addressed if the message is, oh, this is their job. It's like Hollywood. You know, when you see a Hollywood action shot with driving, we would never expect that we would drive like that and flip, you know, three times. So that's an analogy that's used in some pornography education programs and things, or that it's like Olympic level sex. I'm okay with those kinds of analogies too. I mean, I've used them. And that's important, but it really depends on what they're watching. Because if they're watching like hidden camera college dorm stuff or whatever, or they're watching, you know, some other type of homemade something or other that they think is just regular people having sex, they're going to know that doesn't apply because they're not getting paid. But what they don't know is if that person consented to be videoed or have that video shared on the on the website.
Yeah, that is such a helpful frame, and also the sort of critical lens for what they're viewing, and in some ways, really thinking of it as in some settings and in many cases, kind of an exploitative industry. Mm-hmm. That's hard to know whether you're participating in the exploitative side or the consensual side. And there's really no way to know. It sounds like is what you're saying. And as I'm listening to you talk, you're modeling this thing that's hard to do, which is to talk about something that's risky and concerning in a way that we're not saying you're bad, you know, shame on you, right? That we're this sort of like, how do you keep both like positive sexual health messaging, where we don't want to say you're bad for feeling aroused, right? You're bad for having a body or having feelings, and yet not turn away from the sort of the risk and the harms. You know, how do you grapple with sort of wanting to, you know, talking about the harms? Do you have any like tips or ideas for parents about how to walk in that space? And you're already modeling it, so you don't need to have like some.
Well, I mean, it's tough, but really acknowledging whatever your values are as a parent. Maybe you want your kid to be abstinent until marriage. Maybe you want them to be abstinent until adulthood. But there's very few parents who are like, I never want my kid to ever have sex, ever.
Right, ever, yeah.
And as much as it's really embarrassing, you know, especially if these are not conversations that you've had continually, but I think really focusing on the human aspect of sex and how a lot of the sex tech that we're seeing advances in, and it's just going to keep getting more and more immersive.
Right, with artificial intelligence. I feel like we should, let's talk again next year.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the VR porn stuff and sex robots and things like that, nothing compares to like an actual human connection. Yeah. And usually that human connection is built over time. And that's why you can have really satisfying sex and long-term relationships. Sometimes that human connection people do describe in a hookup scenario with somebody they don't know very well. But it is rare that anybody describes great sex as certain positions that they do,
right,
or they looked a certain way. There are data that show that young women in particular who view a lot of pornography have a viewer perspective of their body during sex. Mm. So they're thinking about, you know, is this jiggling? What does my butt look like? What is – instead of really
– the view of a camera as opposed to sort of like cueing into their own their own body. And
And boys and men also thinking about what it looks like instead of thinking and really experiencing what it feels like. So I think people are more receptive to those kinds of messages to think differently about porn than some of the messages that are more common about how horrible it is. Or, you know, depending on your religious beliefs, I mean, it is considered a sin in many religions. And so For people who have that kind of faith system, that might be where the conversation starts and stops. And I would encourage folks, even if you do believe that pornography use is considered a sin, and that's the primary source of why it's, you know, wrong, your kids might not think that. They might not believe that. And so learning about some of these other approaches to talking with them might help open up some communication channels that weren't there otherwise.
Beautiful. Yeah, so beautiful. And I think one of the things I'm wondering is, we've talked a lot about the sort of parent talking to kids, or, you know, in the context of educators doing sex ed, but can you just remind us that we do have some supports? Like, for example, I'm thinking about especially in early adolescence, where maybe our kids don't have a lot of sexual experience yet, but there's a lot of curiosity, there's a lot of change. And sometimes those first forays into pornography are more driven by curiosity, just like stumbling upon it or seeking it out because of curiosity. And certainly talking with parents is important, but what else can we do? Like books, you know, and you don't have to necessarily give specific titles, but just a reminder to parents that we can also say, like, it's okay to be curious. Being curious is normal. You can talk to me, or, you know, what else can we point our kids towards so that, because the curiosity isn't going to go away.
No.
We can say don't do porn, but we can't say don't be curious about sex, because that's developmentally right on time. Right?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So what can we do? You know, can we distribute some of the responsibilities to some incredible authors or you know, other folks?
Yeah. I mean, there's a few different strategies. I mean, one, which we've already been talking about, is how would we directly discuss porn or other sexualized media and get them to think critically about it. But the other piece is just really supporting other sources of information. So books are great, particularly for younger kids who aren't having their own like solo media experiences.
Yeah.
You know, really establishing a good book collection that they can have access to is great, because then you don't have to think about what to say. You can just read a book alongside a younger kid, or, you know, hand it to them and talk about how, you know, there's so many great books out there, and books are a really important source of information because they're hard to get published. They've been vetted a little bit. Yeah. Some of them have even been fact-checked. Whereas whereas what you're going to see on the internet or a Reddit thread or something is not factual information and is not something you should base your decisions off of. So I have an Amazon store, and on my website, there's a link to a bunch of books that I recommend for kids and parents.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Yes. And so I would say start there, because it also just helps. There was somebody who wrote a blog about me recommending this book and reading it to her preschooler so that she would get comfortable saying penis and vagina.
Yeah.
And just how important it is. You know, that's part of our own socialization process.
Totally.
Is we're getting more comfortable with it, and then we're showing them, hey, I can say, you know, mom or dad can say these things.
Yeah.
And it's written in a book.
Yeah.
So it's not just coming from us, because, you know, especially as they get older, they want other sources of information.
For sure.
Books are great for that. But there's also pretty good websites, you know, and really saying, if you don't know the answer to a question that a teen asks, or if you're worried that they don't have information that they need, really saying, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I will connect you with somebody who does, or I'm going to do some research and come back to you about that.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking, kind of a thing. That's also showing that, hey, we are lifelong learners. There's always something to know and figure out. And these things change. I mean, just connecting teens to other sources is also a great way to say, like, hey, you don't have to just go to porn to learn about.
Or go to Google.
Yeah, or even go to Google.
Like, let the algorithm bring you to somewhere that was not the intent, right? Yeah, one of a great piece of advice I got early on was to put our books about bodies and books about sex alongside every other book in the house, right? That it's not in this like secret place where you have to ask for it, or we bring it out ceremoniously three times a year. Like, now we shall say the words. But that they're just sort of like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to put it back up here right by your bed so that you don't have to ask me for it. You don't have to just seek it out. You don't have to trundle through the house with it, especially for teens. I know that we could talk for hours and hours. And I think that we will absolutely be pointing our audience towards your recommendations around books and obviously your website and your blog and other resources. I think what is such a gift of hearing you speak and hearing the way that you think this through and talk about this is that it's just this reminder that we don't have to be experts to get started, that we don't have to do it perfectly because we have more than one chance. In fact, the invitation from you is to give it as many chances as possible to try to figure out and find our way. And so re-listening to this podcast multiple times is allowed as we get comfortable with some of this ourselves. So I just so appreciate your time. I appreciate your willingness to teach undergrads and do the research, but also to really bring it to schools and to parents and to young people themselves. Do you have any final small invitation for our audience? This does not have to be big. This does not have to be earth-shattering, but just like a small act of courage that you invite parents or caring adults to do in the context of what we've been talking about, if they could take one thing, one invitation from you.
Yeah, I would say to find some kind of show that you could watch with your kid that has some type of romantic relationship in it. If you've got a middle schooler, high schooler, even an elementary school kid, you know, there's usually romantic relationships in all sorts of media. I mean, you could do a Disney movie if you got really young
kids. In fact, Disney really goes there.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And just ask them, what do you think about that relationship? And that can be a great way to get started with a conversation just about, you know, norms about romantic relationships. Or do you think they're treating each other well? Or could you imagine, you know, being with somebody like that? Or, you know, some kids are going to be like, ew, gross. You know, and other kids might have something to say, but it'll show, hey, you're willing to talk about this stuff. We could talk about this stuff in the future. So I would invite you to start there if you haven't already had conversations like that already. And even if you've already discussed porn and pleasure and, you know, sexual violence and all sorts of stuff, but just asking questions about what they think about certain TV characters is a great way to understand where they're at in terms of like vocabulary, where they're at in terms of just their own perspective on things. And you'll get more information than saying like, are you dating anybody? Have you had sex yet?
Yeah.
You know, or even is your best friend having sex? I know she's been dating so-and-so for.
Yeah.
So start there, I would say.
I love that. It's so doable.
Yeah.
It's so respectful to young people, and it's so curious. Yeah. And I think it reminds me of that frame that you said, that while we've been in this hour together talking about things like that maybe make our stomachs hurt a little bit, at the core of this work is really about connection and modeling human connection. And that conversation sounds like a beautiful way to step into that. So thank you for your work. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for all that you're doing to help walk us towards these brave and important conversations.
Thank you so much. It was great to chat with you.
Thank you for listening to Connected and Courageous, the art and science of showing up for kids in the digital age, a podcast brought to you by the Spark and Stitch Institute. This podcast is hosted by me, Erin Walsh. Many thanks to our series producer, Beth Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. Music is Still Going Instrumental by John Worthy Music. Warm reminder that the Connected and Courageous podcast does not constitute medical advice and is not a substitute for professional mental health advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have concerns about your child's well-being, consult a physician or mental health professional. For notes, resources, and ways to deepen your engagement with Spark and Stitch or today's guest, visit sparkandstitchinstitute.com. Be sure to subscribe in order to stay up to date with all of the latest offerings. Again, thank you so much for listening. Stay connected, stay courageous. Okay, connected and courageous pod squad. I don't know if I'm allowed to call you that. That might be a little forward. But I am excited to tell you about a course from this episode's guest, Dr. Megan Maas, called Popcorn Parents. It's a one-of-a-kind course that teaches parents everything they wish they didn't need to know about pop culture, pornography, and so much more. I know that parents I talk to across the country right now are struggling with how to talk to their kids about sex, let alone online pornography, sexting, sexual violence. It's really easy to get overwhelmed. Yet, as we just heard in this episode, the stats indicate that these are common experiences for our kids. So we have to find a way to have protective and empowering conversation. In this short episode, we didn't get to dig deep into those sort of scripts and words and what do we say if and what do we say when. So check out Dr. Maas's new course, Pop Porn Parents. It's a clever name with a serious topic. This class is going to help you gain knowledge, shed embarrassment, and establish a strong relationship that can handle these difficult but important conversations so your kid can thrive. And our listeners can receive 50% off with the code SPARKSTITCH. Just enter SPARK, SPARKSTITCH at checkout to receive this special discount. So you can access the course link in our show notes at sparkandstitchinstitute.com/podcast. Look for today's episode and find it there. We don't have any horse in the race on this one. Just want to share meaningful resources that'll make a difference in your life. And we think Dr. Maas is doing great work. So check out her course. Bye.